It is Friday, January 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. Senate resumes debate on a spending measure to avert a government shutdown. We speak with the head of the research team that has developed a new blood test that yields encouraging results about cancers.
Pancreatic cancer, ovarian cancer, or other cancers that they do not right now have any screening modality or any screening test for them, that will be huge in the future.
And we look at the new film 12 Strong, which portrays U.S. troops fighting in Afghanistan soon after the September 11th, 2001 terror attacks. It's all ahead. The United States Senate resumed debate Friday morning on a bill passed by the House of Representatives late Thursday that will fund government operations beyond midnight Friday. U.S. President Donald Trump acknowledged in a tweet that Democratic votes are needed to approve the measure. But he suggested Democrats' demands for immigration protection could derail chances for the bill's passage and lead to a government shutdown. I spoke with VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson about the impasse.
What we are actually doing right now up here is just beginning that debate, which, as we look at it now, doesn't seem to be going much of anywhere. The two camps have really divided quite cleanly and are not budging right now. Republicans are saying that this is a problem with Democrats pandering to their base on what they call the issue of illegal immigration. Now, Democrats, of course, would see that very, very differently. They say that this is an issue of helping out those DACA recipients, those children who were brought to the U.S. undocumented when they were younger and now have uncertain legal status here in the United States. So unless that issue is resolved, it looks like we will indeed have a government shutdown.
Wow. So I guess the options there, the senators could either agree on another, you know, a temporary spending measure, which has been going, continuing resolution, which is what we've seen for the last, I think, several months. They keep having these, or actually shut down at least part of the government.
That's right. This is where it gets a little bit complicated. And you have to remember that we've been under these so-called continuing resolutions. This is our fifth go-around if it actually passes. And continuing resolution is just Washington speak for short-term government funding. Now, we're in such a loggerheads right now that one option being floated is that there would be a one-week short-term spending deal to give Republicans and Democrats just a little bit more time to work out this DACA fix. You know, Congress really works best on a deadline when they're under the gun and they have something that they just have to get done. So this is really a really last-minute deal if it does go through.
However, now the House, I guess, has passed this measure.
That's right. We were here late last night working out a very interesting deal between some of the members of the more conservative parts of the House of Representatives who really hate that we keep going through these short-term spending measures. They say that it's really dangerous in terms of adequately funding the nation's military. So in return for that, from Speaker Ryan, they extracted a deal to get their conservative immigration bill up for a floor vote within the next few weeks. So expect to see that debate coming up soon, and that will be very interesting because that'll be tough for some of the more moderate members of the House to vote on.
VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's trending?
Well, we have two competing marches going on today and tomorrow here in Washington, D.C. Today is the annual March for Life. This is a march in support of the pro-life movement. In other words, these are people who are opposed to abortion rights. And this has been going on since just a few years after the Roe v. Wade decision in the early 1970s. And so lots of people talking about that, and as well as tomorrow's quote-unquote Women's March. This is will be the second annual Women's March, the first, of course, last year, just a day after Mr. Trump's inaugural drew many, many, many people to Washington. The streets were absolutely clogged. So people kind of battling back and forth on social media talking about, and I'm just going to share a number of the views because there's a lot of views. There's a lot of very strong feelings about these issues. Christopher Zulo writes, "No one likes abortion. Everyone wants to prevent it. The problem is the Republican policy of ignorance. If you want to prevent needless abortions, you offer free birth control and sex education." Shannon Coulter writes, "In a country where abortion is legal, it's disgusting and unforgivable for a sitting U.S. president to speak at an abortion, anti-abortion rights rally." Of course, the president will be addressing the crowds later today via TV link. Here's Conservazilla. "Abortion has claimed the lives of 60 million unborn children. Planned Parenthood is responsible for more deaths than every dictator that has ravaged the earth." Kellyanne Conway, one of the president's counselors, tweeting this out, "President Donald Trump is the most pro-life president in our nation's history." Jennifer Gunter, "You are not pro-life. You are pro-forced birth. If you were pro-life, you would advocate for universal health care and gun control." So you can see a lot of issues getting all kind of mixed up. And that's really no surprise, just given the level, the intensity, I suppose, of emotion and feeling that the topic of abortion creates in people, and the broader topics that here as it's being expanded about universal access to health care, gun rights, that kind of thing. So people kind of really battling it out for their views on social media regarding these two rallies today.
All right. Thanks very much, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories trending. 32 children have been rescued from Al-Shabaab in Somalia. India's top court faces a credibility crisis. Vice President Mike Pence heads to the Middle East. And UN African ambassadors are taking issue with President Donald Trump's reported racist comments. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study by researchers at the Harvard Medical School and Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center finds that dying or dead cancer cells as the result of chemotherapy can continue to cause harm to the cancer patient. The study finds that debris from cells killed or are being killed by chemotherapy produces a kind of inflammation that stimulates aggressive tumor growth. The researchers say that their findings show similar effects that coincide with decades-old studies on radiation-generated cancer cell debris. To stop this recurring loop of destroying cancer cells that go on to encourage rapid tumor growth, the researchers found that resolvins, a class of naturally produced molecules, can stop the inflammation and encourage the digestion of the dead cancer cell debris. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the 45th pro-life rally is taking place here in Washington. Scientists at the United States Johns Hopkins University are reporting progress in developing a blood test to detect 8 types of cancer at an early stage, including some of the most deadly ones that are currently difficult to detect with existing screening tools. In blood samples from more than 1,000 patients, the test detected about 70% of the cancers. Ovarian cancer was the easiest to detect, followed by liver, stomach, pancreas, esophageal, colorectal, lung, and breast cancers. I spoke with the leader of the research team that developed the blood test, Dr. Nicholas Papadopoulos, who explains how the test works.
It's a simple test as far as the individual who takes the test is. All they have to do is give a little bit of blood. And then in that blood, we take the plasma from the blood, which means that it doesn't have any cells in there. And what we detect is DNA, which is the genetic material that is present in all of our cells, but we have developed a method to detect DNA that comes only from the cancer cells, and that is actually in trace amounts and required many years of developing technologies to actually do that. And also, we detect proteins, biomarkers, if you wish, that they are also come from the cancer cells. So it's a combination of looking both at DNA and protein from cancer cells in blood.
Certainly some of these cancers, like ovarian cancer, pancreatic cancer, have been traditionally very hard to really detect until they're spread, till they're almost lethal. So, I mean, this would give doctors certainly greater help in helping patients.
Well, yeah, that's the whole idea and the reason we're doing this, to try to detect cancers as earlier as possible for exactly the reason you said. We know from years of observations that when cancers are identified for one reason or the other early, surgeries are more successful, therapies are more successful, and we're not talking about prolonging life for in months or a few years, but actually have actual cures. So the trick is to find them early. The issue is that these people usually do not have symptoms. That's one of the tricks that cancer plays with us. It grows inside us, and we feel fine until we start having something like a pain or a cough or something like that, and many times it's too late. So detecting cancers, like as you said, pancreatic cancer, ovarian cancer, or other cancers that they do not right now have any screening modality or any screening test for them, that will be huge in the future. We're not there yet. I mean, we still need to detect more if we can, but I think we are in a very good start, going from nothing to something. I think it's pretty good.
Well, apparently a larger study is underway.
Yeah.
And how will that study work?
So this one, that I'll take a step back. This study that just published, it's the first step, if you will. I told you we were working 20 years to develop the technologies, but it's the first step to actually bringing it out to the real world. And so in this study that it just published, we knew, as you said, we had 8 different cancers, and then we had, of course, controls. Now, the new study that is coming up, that is already started with thousands of people, those are all people that they do not have symptoms, or they don't have cancer, at least known cancer. So it really, the new study is different in that it simulates what is going to be the population that this test will be applied to. And hopefully we will get good results.
Dr. Nicholas Papadopoulos, professor of oncology and pathology at the Johns Hopkins Kimmel Cancer Center in Baltimore. The 45th annual March for Life rally is taking place in Washington. President Trump is scheduled to speak at the pro-life anti-abortion event by satellite from the White House. The rally also coincides with the 45th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, a Supreme Court ruling that legalized abortion here in the United States. Pro-choice supporters favor the law, while anti-abortionists want the decision reversed. VOA's Deborah Block looks at the debate over the issue.
It was in 1973 that the Supreme Court confirmed the legality of a woman's right to have an abortion under the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which protects the right to privacy through political means and rallies. Both pro-life and pro-choice supporters have been making their voices heard ever since.
We are trying to protect babies in any way that we can through legislation now.
We're for legal abortion, safe abortion. We're for the woman making her own mind.
Pro-lifers hope their cause will be advanced by the conservative Trump administration. That includes the president's Supreme Court appointee, Neil Gorsuch, who believes the Constitution does not protect the right to abortion. Another way to abolish abortion is through state laws, says Carol Tobias, president of the National Right to Life Committee.
We want to see abortion not occurring in every state. So if you have a state legislature and a governor who is working with our state affiliates to pass laws to protect the babies, to protect the moms, I think that's great.
But making abortion illegal does not protect people, says Eleanor Smeal, head of the Feminist Majority Foundation.
When you are forcing people against their will to reproduce at times that are very difficult for them, you are actually having a negative impact on their health and well-being and the health and well-being of their family.
DeBaya says moves by the Republican-led administration show efforts are going forward to abolish abortion. President Trump's global gag rule, for example, prevents U.S. funding from going to any overseas organizations that promote or perform abortion. Tobias is also hopeful that pro-life legislation put forward in the U.S. House of Representatives may eventually be approved by the Senate.
We are very happy that they've already in this session passed the No Taxpayer Funding for Abortion Act.
But Smeal thinks those efforts are out of step with most American public opinion on abortion.
All they're doing is making it tougher on people. Making it, and they're not going, whether it's legal or illegal, it's going to occur.
Years ago, President Trump said he was pro-choice. But during his presidential campaign, he expressed the opinion that there has to be some sort of punishment for people who have abortions. Both Tobias and Smeal are in agreement. That is a bad idea. In the latest in the debate over pro-life, the Trump administration said Thursday it is creating an office to protect the religious rights of medical providers, including those who oppose abortion. Deborah Block, VOA News.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition, a new film from Emmy-winning producer Jerry Bruckheimer and starring Chris Hemsworth, 12 Strong, tells the story of a special forces unit that fought on horseback in the early days of the Afghan War. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, the unit was one of the first American fighting forces in Afghanistan after the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks.
Audiences are used to seeing Chris Hemsworth as the comic book hero Thor in the Marvel Comic Universe movies. But now the Australian is playing a real hero, Captain Mitch Nelson, a role based on real-life Captain Mark Nutch, who led the so-called horse soldiers that fought with an Afghan warlord to take down the Taliban in 2001. At the New York premiere, Hemsworth said he would not have believed the story had he not worked with some of the actual soldiers on the film.
Remarkable story, and one that I felt a privilege to even sort of be reading it and be a part of it. And you know, once I'd met the real guys themselves, the soldiers, the Special Forces team, there was a whole lot of anxiety, I've got to say, and sort of I felt the weight of that responsibility to portray this story and do them justice. But incredibly rewarding and one of the best experiences I've had.
We're teaming up with a warlord that we know nothing about. We're not going to be able to tell our enemies from our allies. Every step we take is going to be on a minefield from 100 different wars. And no one's ever called in a smart bomb airstrike from a B-52. So anyone who tells you they've done this before, has experience in this, is lying, sir. There's no playbook here. We're going to have to write it ourselves.
I briefed five potential captains for this mission. About 100 years of military experience between them. But you're the only one that sees it the way it is. I choose you. You and 11 men.
Comedic actor Rob Riggle plays Lieutenant Colonel Max Bowers, a man he served under in the Horse Soldiers when he was deployed to Afghanistan as a U.S. Marine.
Having served as a Marine for 23 years and served in Afghanistan twice and served with this actual unit, this story takes place in October of 2001. I was actually attached to this unit in November of 2001. And the guy that I am playing in the movie, Lieutenant Colonel Max Bowers, was my direct boss when I was in Afghanistan. So I worked directly for the man I'm now playing in the movie. So I feel like I knew him pretty well.
Michael Pena plays Sergeant First Class Sam Diller. He says the movie honors those who fought and also helps people remember the sacrifices made by American troops and their Afghan allies.
And movies allow you to never forget and always be... You know, just know your history. You know, this is a movie that my kid's probably gonna see in like, you know, 5-6 years. He's 9 now. So it serves as that purpose as well. But also it celebrates like the Afghan people that helped those 12 soldiers along the way. And, you know, it's a celebration of them because I'm like, they're not all terrorists, you know. The majority of them are very good people and they want peace as well.
Producer Jerry Bruckheimer said at the premiere in New York that it was important to tell the Horse Soldiers story.
Well, it was really important to tell the story as it actually happened from the guys. We had the real soldiers work with us, the guys who were over there. Rob, who was over there and actually worked with one of our generals, was a great inspiration to our guys to tell them how well the mission was. So it was terrific to have somebody with a sense of humor like Rob and somebody with a verisimilitude who actually was in the Army at that time and over there.
12 Strong is rated R for war, violence, and language throughout. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Thanks very much, David, and that is our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
ISIS has lost the vast majority of the territory it once held in Syria, as it has in Iraq. But while Russia may consider the fight in Syria to be over, U.S. Acting Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs David Satterfield said recently before Congress that the United States remains committed to the total and enduring defeat of ISIS and other terrorist groups in Syria and the region, and to ensuring that they cannot regenerate and return. One thing that such an enduring defeat requires is a credible political process leading to a government chosen by the Syrian people without Bashar al-Assad at the helm. They've inflicted suffering and countless deaths on the Syrian people. This regime is a magnet for terror, Mr. Satterfield said. And while acknowledging the grave challenges ahead, he declared that with the UN-led Geneva process and international support for credible electoral and constitutional reform, political transition in Syria is a potentially achievable goal. Progress toward that goal depends in part on Assad's ally, Russia. We're going to need Russia to put pressure on the regime to abide by Security Council Resolution 2254 and participate in political discussions in Geneva. Why should Russia do that? Mr. Satterfield asked. Because minus such engagement, there's going to be no money coming into Syria for reconstruction. There's going to be no legitimization from the broad international community, either for Russia or for Syria. Resolution 2254's political process is the key, Mr. Satterfield declared. It is the key to addressing Assad in his departure. It is the key to resolving the question of foreign forces and Iranian influence. And our tools to move that process forward, he said, include the denial of legitimacy and authenticity to any claim of victory by the regime or its supporters in Moscow or Tehran, and the withholding of reconstruction funds, which are vital to the regime and Moscow's interests over the long term. The United States, Acting Assistant Secretary Satterfield said, is committed to remaining in Syria to achieve all of our strategic goals, including the enduring defeat of ISIS, progress on a Syrian political transition, and a diminution of Iran's malign influence in and around Syria. The evaluation of these goals, he declared, will not be based on calendars, but on the assessment of conditions reviewed on a progressive basis over the time ahead.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.